This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Wa usalli wa usallam ala Sayyidil Awwaleen wal Akhireen, Nabiyyina Muhammadin, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa barak wa sallam. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be constantly showered upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the master of the first and the last, and his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the day of judgment. As to what follows, my beloved brothers and sisters, to our friends, our viewers, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Alhamdulillah, we are continuing on in our series of minarets and thrones. And this is really a critical topic to look at the relationship of leaders to scholars. And we recognize that leadership is a very crucial issue. It has always been, and it will always be. It's not the basis of power in Islam, but the leader is like the head or the heart, you know, in the body, very crucial to the existence of the body. And just this week was a major meeting in Saudi Arabia, you know, of the heads of state of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab states. And they met concerning the crisis in the Middle East. And there were the leaders of 57 countries were represented. And I took some time to look at some of the leaders, listen to some of what they were saying. And I realized that the leaders who were there were primarily just political rulers. They may control their country because of their family, or because of their wealth or their military. But you couldn't really find somebody who actually represents the people themselves and then fully represents Islam. There are a few of the leaders who are trying in their own way. Their countries are divided up, like in the case of Turkey. There's the seculars fighting against the Muslims, and their leadership is trying in the best way Islamically, but a key element in that meeting was missing, and that is scholars. Remember the formula. The leader has political power, economic, military, but the scholar is the one who understands the revelation, the one who can give direction to the power of the leader. And if you don't have that involved, then people are basically judging issues on their own ego or on their political situation, their interests, not necessarily on the interests of Islam. The meeting started off with the recitation of the Quran, but the person who read, you know, and Allah knows best, did not appear to be a person who was really into what he was reading. And that was the closest to anybody who had any connection with the revelation. And so fusion is one way out. And that is that if there is a leader who has political power, but also is God-fearing, they have taqwa, the person has both, as in the case of Umar ibn Khattab, radiallahu anhu, you know, one of the best examples, that could be a way out. But there's nobody like that. Nobody in the Muslim world. A few of the leaders who are there are humble people in their own way, but they're not connected with the type of knowledge that is needed to really make a difference. And so 57 countries, critical situation in the Muslim world, people dying, Islamic decisions need to be made. Direction needs to be given. This is why this subject here is so important. And if these 57 countries and their representatives cannot find solutions, then somebody has to. The younger generation who are coming up, maybe Allah will replace these leaders with other leaders. And so we are looking at historically what happened, what is the relationships, and what is the result when you had a good, positive relationship between the leaders and the rulers. And so we want to go back to the 11th century AD, at the time of the ruling Abbasid Empire. And we had looked at the rulers. There was the Khulafa Rashidin, the rightly guided caliphs, and then there was the Umayyad dynasty, which was a kingdom, and they ruled for about 100 years or so. And then it went on to the Abbasids. They seized power, and they were the rulers at this point in time of the Muslim world. The leaders, although they had, legally they had the authority, they did not really have what it takes. And so this is where, by the will of Allah, connections could be made to save the Muslim world from the crisis that it was in at that point in time. This is where Allah brought to the scene a group of people who were not originally Muslims, who were hostile to the Muslims. Allah opened their hearts, and they became a powerful part of the Muslim world. Remember replacement, that if we don't practice Islam, Allah will replace us. And that is something which is predicted and it is promised in the Quran itself. And so this group was called the Seljuks, the Seljuk Empire. And they were a Turco-Persian Sunni Muslim empire. That's a lot of words. So they are Turkish people, and I'll show you where Turkish people come from. But they're also mixed with Persians and Persian culture. So it was more Turkish people who took on Persian culture. And they were Sunni, meaning Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah. And they originated from the Kinnik branch of the Oghuz Turks. And the Oghuz Turks are people who live in Central Asia. They are, it is a rough environment. And they are known for their skills as warriors. And you can see the clothing now, like many young people are watching the MMA, and they watch Habib and, you know, Islam and Hamza and the Dagestanis and the Chechens. And you see when Habib wins, whenever they win, they put on their cap. So this is the Chechen Dagestani cap. Now, it can be different colors based upon the fur, you know, of the sheep. This is to protect you in the winter. And this hat is very significant to the people historically. In the past, it has a lot of meaning to it. So this is a typical group. Within our own lifetimes, this is not from 1,000 years ago. But you can still see they are carrying a lot of the traditions of the Oghuz. So Oghuz is the general name of the Turkish people. And the homeland of the Turkish people is basically in this area surrounded by red, what is now mainly Kazakhstan, but there's also Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, right, and Tajikistan. And these areas there, this is sort of the homeland, you could say, of the Turkish nation. And right next to it, of course, is Mongolia. And in ancient times, there was a proto-Turkish-Mongolian group from which both sides came from. So somehow in the Altai Mountains, which is in between Kazakhstan and Mongolia, these groups separated into different nations, tribal groupings. These names, Uzbekistan, these are political countries. But generally, Uzbekistan really means the home of Uzbeks, so which have their own language and their culture, and the same as Tajikistan have their own culture and their language, okay? And you can see Afghanistan as well, but that's not the original Turkish areas, okay? Now, the Seljuks who were in this area, in their relationship with the Muslim world, they were generally hostile, but it is somewhere around the 11th century when contact came through wars that were happening between the Muslims and Chinese dynasties, that the Muslims came in contact with the Turks. And they were amazed at their fighting skills and their courage. And so they joined on with the Muslims, became highly educated, and generally they were mercenaries, slaves, and that's not ball and chain slave in a plantation, right? This is somebody who's controlled, you know, by a master, but they were basically mercenaries, okay? So they're like slave soldiers in a sense. The Seljuks, as a group, started to move west. So you can see, if we go back to their roots, you see Mongolia, and the Mongols started to burst out of their territories, and we understood that with mistakes made by Muslims, Khwarizmi, you know, area, they insulted the Turks, and their leader, Genghis Khan, wanted to take over the world. So what was happening is that Mongolia, feeling its power and being united, wanted to go to brighter pastures. It's a very difficult country to live in because it's extremely cold in the winter. It's extremely hot in the summer. And the Gobi Desert is one of the most difficult deserts in the world. So not an easy country to live in. So they were looking out for greener pastures in other parts of the world. And so the Mongols then, you could say, pushed the Seljuks and other people west. So they, under the pressure of the Mongol expansion, they started to go west. And it was around 1037 that Tughril Bey, they used the name Bey, meaning their leader, Tughril Bey and Chagatai Bey, they really formed an empire, a dynasty. Their progenitor, Seljuk, his name was Seljuk. He is like their grandfather. Okay, but it's really Tughril and Chagatai that really brought them together and united them. And they lived somewhere in the area of the Aral Sea, okay, which is in Kazakhstan. It's not shown on that map, but it's sort of north center there and then going west. Okay, and but then they started to move into Khorasan. And Khorasan, going back to our map again, would be what is now northern Afghanistan and also Iran, the northern part of Iran, right? And all that area there is what's called Khorasan. And Khorasan is a very important name, by the way, because even in our Hadith traditions, it says near the end of time that there will be leaders. They even say the Mahdi, you know, his forces will be coming out of Khorasan. So it mentions the name Khorasan. Okay, so it still is an important area, but now would be in Afghanistan and parts of northern Iran. So they moved into this area, and they continued. And because of their organization and their strength, they actually began to take over territory. It was not necessarily hostile takeovers, because they were in Muslim lands, and the Muslims realized they needed somebody to protect them, especially when the Mongols were coming. So they started to take over territory and to take over land until they actually moved into the area of Iraq in Baghdad. Around 1055, they reached in this area. And there was a great crisis that was going on there in Iraq because a Shiite group, you know, they had seized control of Baghdad, and they were teaching different concepts, not the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, but concepts based on, you know, Shiite ideology. And we'll talk a little bit more you know, about this Shia threat that was happening at that time. But the Seljuks, because they did take over this area, Baghdad, which is the capital, so they became, in a sense, the protectors of the Muslim world. They were now de facto rulers of the Muslim world. They were not the Khalifas because they were not Abbasids. They didn't come from the Quraysh. But in effect, they were ruling. And some of the most famous names amongst the Seljuks, probably the most famous after the founders, is Alp Arslan, who was a great leader. There, he expanded them into what is now present-day Turkey, and then going all the way over, even towards Europe and other areas. And he united and expanded them as well. And underneath them, of course, under Alp Arslan, you know, who died, you know, just after a battle, his son Malik Shah took over. But underneath the leaders is a new group, you could say, in a sense. It's not part of the original Islamic terminologies. But the term came in wazir. So the wazir is like what we would say the chief minister, the secretary of state, but not just the representative. The wazir has got, he is like, you could say the prime minister. I mean, you can see, you know, in the UK and England, you have the king, and then you have the parliament, and you have the prime minister. So there's a prime minister. But the problem is now in England, the king has no power. He's just ceremony. But in those days, the sultan did have power. However, his prime minister, the wazir, was extremely powerful. So underneath the two rulers, Alp Arslan and Malik Shah, was a famous person named Nizam al-Mulk. Nizam al-Mulk. And this is like a title. Because Nizam means like Nizam, you would say in Arabic. It's sort of like the one who organizes the kingdom. And another great wazir was Taj al-Mulk. So Taj al-Mulk also, so these two were very famous and played great roles in helping them to organize themselves. And because of this, they started to really expand. So they expanded all the way to China. And as I said, way far to the west in the Roman lands, the lands of the Byzantines. And this is a map. This orange area here shows you the extent that the Seljuk reached. This is a huge swath of territory. You can only start to compare this with the Roman Empire and with, you know, Alexander the Great. You know, so this is a huge territory, especially when you don't have telephones and cell phones and mass communications. So this requires a lot of organization to dominate and control this area. And this is what is considered to be the Seljuk Empire, which to a great extent is the heartlands of Islam. And so Nizam al-Mulk, he organized a lot of the internal administration, you know, of the Seljuks. And in a work that he actually did, Siyasat Nama, he wrote a text on the book of the government, how you rule, an Islamic government. What is the principles to stay in power, and how to organize bureaucracy? The same way today you have ministry of this, minister of that. You have different House representatives and, you know, local organization. How to effectively run a mass organization? So this is one of the great achievements of Nizam al-Mulk. And because of this, they were able to prosper not only militarily, but also economically. And as protectors of the Muslim world, part of their protection was to keep the purity of Islam. That the basic rule would be according to the Book of Allah and the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him. And at that time, there was a great challenge. And this challenge was led by the Shiite Fatimid dynasty. And the Fatimids, As we have studied in previous classes here, the Fatimids are part of the Shia dynasty that came out of the son of Ali ibn Abi Talib and Fatima, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Ahlul Bayt, right? So Hassan and Hussein are the two sons, but from Hussein's side, okay, the Shias started to group first to protect the family and to oppose the Umayyads, but later they started having their own ideology because they grouped themselves mainly in Iraq, in Basra and in Kufa and in these areas. And these were areas of magic and the occult. A lot of the underground groups are there. The Quran even says that when magic was first introduced, like in Surah Al-Baqarah, it says that Harut and Marut, the angels, they brought magic into Babel. That's Babylon. So the concept of magic, these secret societies, communication with the jinn, right, using evil and darkness, these groupings and occult, this is where it was introduced. So some of the most dangerous occult groups, most magicians, most groups in the world who are dealing with magic, they will eventually go back to Iraq. Because this is where it actually began. And so the combination of wanting to protect the family of the Prophet and then the introduction of these extreme groups, a new type of religious Shiism developed. This is not political Shiism. Political Shiism is only to protect the family of the Prophet, and in terms of prayer and their concept of leadership is the same. But in religious, they looked at the imams as infallible, that they don't make mistakes. And they're almost like prophets, better than some of the prophets. And this, of course, is outside of Islam, along with so many other beliefs. And so from back in the 9th century is the early formation of Shiism. So this is even before the time of the Seljuks. One of these missionaries out of Kufa, whose name was Abu Abdullah al-Hussein al-Shi'i, right, out of Kufa and then out of Yemen. Okay, because from Kufa they went down into Yemen. Okay, so he proclaimed himself to be al-Bab. He is the door to the Mahdi. Because they believed that the imamate stopped at 12, and the 12th imam had hidden himself in a cave, and he was alive. He was the Mahdi. So this Hussein person here, he claimed he was the door to the Mahdi. So he had all the blessings and the barakah and whatnot. And he moved from Yemen to North Africa. And he founded a base of operation in a place that they later called Al-Mahdiya, which is in present-day Tunisia. So these are actually pictures of Tunisia. Okay, and some of the buildings built by the group called the Fatimids, formed by Al-Hassan Al-Hussein Al-Shi'i, you know, they built some of these buildings. Some of the structures are still there. Okay, so the base was Tunisia, and then they moved east to Egypt. And they were highly organized. They're good preachers, or you know, effective preachers. They brought wealth with them, highly successful in their organization, and they succeeded in taking over Egypt. Remember, the Abbasids and the other people at that time were over in Iraq. And so the Fatimids, and it's a long story, but they succeeded in taking over that area. And eventually they spread their rule. So the orange area that you see here, all of this was controlled by the Fatimids. Okay, so this was a strange world because you had the Abbasids who were in Iraq. You had the Fatimids claiming to be the Khalifa, Shia. And then you also had one of the Umayyads that had escaped to Spain, Al-Andalusia, and he formed an Umayyad dynasty there in Al-Andalus, in Spain. So there was a Khalifa there. There was three Khalifas. So strange time, right? But the Fatimids now were highly successful in their organization. They founded what is now the present-day Cairo. There was a small military base called Al-Fustat. That was there before. But in terms of the base, as a sprawling city, they were the ones that founded it, building walls, you know, extending aqueducts, and then building huge masjids, mausoleums, and they even established a university. And that was to teach Shia teachings. It was called Al-Azhar University. And we know Al-Azhar today as one of the great universities in the Muslim world. They was originally Shia. It was a Shiite university. And it wasn't until the time later on when Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, the great Sultan, fighting the Crusaders, he took over Egypt. And he was a Kurdish leader fighting with the Turkish Zengids. He took over Egypt, and then he converted Al-Azhar to the Sunnah, the Shafi'i fiqh. So Shafi'i fiqh became the rule there. But still you will see buildings like this that are there, huge buildings still there in Cairo that were built by the Fatimids. Okay, so this group then represented a threat. Look at the size of it. So this is a major threat to the whole Muslim world. And they were expanding. They even expanded, you can see, to the point where they took over Mecca and Medina. And they took over Jerusalem. So at one point, the Fatimids were controlling the three holy sites in Islam. Unfortunately, because of the weakness of their faith, they lost Jerusalem to the Crusaders. And they even started making deals with the Crusaders and started working with the Crusaders. So when the Seljuks came in, they had to struggle with these schismatic Shiite groups, some from the Fatimids and other little groups like the Buwayids that came out. And they had to fight with the Crusaders. And so it was a serious time. Seljuks had, major struggle. So remember, rulers, scholars. So we want to look at the key two individuals here that represent this blending together. And that is the ruler who was the wazir, and that is Nizam al-Mulk. And his name was Abu Ali al-Hasan ibn Ali at-Tusi. So he came from the town of At-Tus, which is in modern-day Iran. It was in Persia. Okay, so he was a Persian person as well. And great statesman, organized, not only in administration, as we will see, he was involved in education. And this is really where he shines as well. And he developed a relationship with the scholars. And the most famous scholar who had a relationship with him was Imam al-Ghazali, rahimahullah, the great, one of the greatest scholars in Islamic history. So Nizam al-Mulk had great respect for the scholars, and he enabled them. He empowered them. And he had the power of the state. And you can now see, you could see the size of the Seljuk Empire. Now, who was Imam al-Ghazali? So Imam al-Ghazali, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, he was born in Tus, same place as Nizam al-Mulk. So he was also from Tus. It's part of Khorasan, remember that northern part of Iran. So he was born there in Tus, and his father passed away when he was very young. And he was given over to the scholars. From a young age, he started to get into Islamic education. And one of the qualities of Imam al-Ghazali, he had like a photogenic memory. It's the type of memory, some people have this memory that when they look at something, when they look at a page, when they learn information, it stays in their head as though their head is what we would call today a hard drive. Right? So your hard drive is in your head. Okay, so this memory that he had, he became an excellent student in fiqh, jurisprudence, in aqidah. He even started reading books on philosophy. And he was fortunate to come under the tutelage of a great scholar, Imam al-Juwayni. And Imam al-Juwayni was one of the famous scholars at that time in the Muslim world. So he came under the tutelage of Imam al-Juwayni and spent a lot of time under him, inheriting, in a sense, this great encyclopedic knowledge. So this was Imam al-Ghazali. Every class he entered, he was on the top. And as a young man, not only could he teach, but he also started writing. And his works, some of the great works that he did, there's a lot of works that he did, but one of his famous works, Tahafat al-Falsafa, which is the incoherence of the philosophers, he actually criticized people like Ibn Sina and al-Farabi because not only were they great scientists or great doctors, but also they went into philosophy. And they had some Ismaili leanings as well. So Imam al-Ghazali, he saved the Ummah in a sense. Because this was the time, as we learned, that philosophy is coming in, books are being translated, and this caused a confusion to a certain extent in Islamic learning. In the old days, you want the Quran, you want Sunnah, you learn Arabic, and you don't have that much to really contend with. Now, everything they could find was being translated into Arabic. So Imam al-Ghazali was one of the people who studied the teachings of European philosophers, and he criticized them, and he criticized also Muslim philosophers who had gone astray. But a lot of people, when they think of Imam al-Ghazali, they think of him more as a philosopher and a Sufi scholar, a mystical type of scholar when they hear the name al-Ghazali. But they don't realize that Imam al-Ghazali was actually considered to be the Sheikh al-Islam. He was considered, in the in Islamic world to be like one of the most important scholars in the whole of the Muslim world. And that is not just philosophy and it's not just spirituality. Even in fiqh, he actually mastered all of the sciences. So if you start talking about grammar, he's mastering the grammar. You start talking about poetry, he's mastering poetry. You go into tafsir, he's mastering tafsir. Now, he was so strong in fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, that he laid foundations for fiqh called Usul al-Fiqh, al-Mustasfa. And his book Al-Mustasfa is still one of the main books in Usul al-Fiqh today. Okay? So if you want to look at fiqh, especially in the Shafi'i school of thought, Al-Mustasfa is one of the key books, and it's influencing people legally up until today. So this is how powerful Imam al-Ghazali was in terms of the basic knowledge that he had. And now, what is the relationship of the rulers and the scholars? Nizam al-Mulk had developed a series of madrasas. And so this system was called Nizamiya. So the Nizamiya madrasa system. And this Nizamiya was spread to different parts of the Muslim world. And some of the books that we use, like Al-Qaeda, Al-Baghdadiya, if you're learning Tajweed and things, some of these books actually go back to the Nizamiya. And if you study Hanafi fiqh, and You know, Shafi, some of the texts you're reading go back to the Nizamiya, madrasa in Baghdad. Okay, so the main madrasa was in Baghdad, but they opened up centers in different areas. Imam al-Ghazali got connected with one of the centers in the area of Persia where he was living in Khorasan. And because of his brilliance, his reputation reached Nizam al-Mulk. And Nizam al-Mulk, because of his love of scholarship and wanting to advance the Muslim world, he invited Imam al-Ghazali to come to Baghdad, that he would be one of the great teachers in the most prestigious institute in the world. It was really the pinnacle at that time. And so he accepted this, and he became one of the leading scholars. And after a short period of time, because of his literal ability to take in information and to compare and to understand, his reputation was widespread, and he became the leading scholar of the Nizamiya Institute in Baghdad. Okay, now, this university, you could call it today, was not only just situated in Baghdad, it was financed through Nizam al-Mulk by the Seljuks and the Abbasids. So therefore, the wealth that had come into the Muslim world at that time, you could say that Baghdad was one of the richest cities in the world, was this area. Unlimited amounts of gold and silver. And so they enabled the scholars. They financed their work. They financed research work. They financed traveling. They financed the writing of books. As we've learned in different classes before, even the papyrus in Egypt, which is hard to get, the Muslims found out about papyrus from the Chinese. And they actually exported it. And they brought it from China into the Muslim world. And bookbinding, until the books produced in the Muslim world exceeded the ones in China. So they became the leading book people on earth. Europe at that time did not have books, only in Al-Andalus, which was Muslim Spain and Portugal. Okay, there the Muslims, of course, had institutes. They're connected with Baghdad, great cities of Cordoba and Granada and Toledo. They were connected. But other parts of Europe, the Germans, the French, the British, Scandinavia, they were in darkness. Right? They did not have bookbinding, writing, any of the things that we understand, you know, is part of scholarship. Now, the challenge, the importance of this relationship, and again, we're in a crisis today, and we need this kind of a relationship to come again, where scholars support leaders. If these leaders who gather together in this major leading can't do anything but complain to the United Nations, or just write another paper, they need somebody to fire them up. They need somebody to make them realize what their responsibility is as leaders in the Muslim world. And that's what the ulama are supposed to be doing. Okay? So what happened in this time? In this time, as we learned, there was a great challenge with the Fatimid dynasty. It was a power struggle. They were the leading power groups in the Muslim world. The struggle was not just military or economic, it was ideas. Because the Fatimids were bringing in strange ideas that we call Batiniya. And we have done a course on this in sects and groups in Islam, in the Muslim world, right, to show the different groups. And the Batiniya groups are the ones who use this philosophy from the occult, and they put it into the Muslim world. And a lot of schismatic groups started to develop out of this Batiniya teachings. And the Fatimids took this on. And from the Fatimids, as we know, one group broke away from them because they thought the Fatimids were not extreme enough. Their leader was Muhammad ibn Ismail al-Darzi, and they thought that, you know, he said that God is in him, and he took it to Lebanon, and he formed a group called Duruz, the Duruz. You'll see this name in Lebanon and in Palestine and in occupied, you know, territories, these Duruz people. So the Duruz are not Muslims, they're not Christians, they're not Jewish. They have their own religion. They're extreme Shia, to the point where the mainstream Shias consider them to be not Muslims. So these schismatic groups were developing, and they're spreading poison. So they were spreading their teachers, people who do their dawah, their evil dawah, into the Seljuk lands, the lands of the Abbasids, to teach these strange underground Bataniya teachings. And they use a lot of philosophy. They can catch people up in words. Okay, so somebody had to respond. And this is where the Nizamiya group, led by Imam al-Ghazali, took the stand against them. Because Imam al-Ghazali was not a regular scholar. He goes beyond the text. So he can literally listen to your philosophical argument, and he can counter, he can refute you. Okay? So they addressed the theological arguments, the philosophical arguments that were coming out of the schismatic groups that were there. And there was even one group which was led by a person called Hassan al-Sabah, and they called themselves Hashashin. And this Hashashin group, which came out of the major Shiite sect called Ismailis. Okay, so the Ismailis really is the Fatimids. So it's a wing of the Ismailis. And their leader went into the mountains of Syria in this area, and he formed his group. And he was totally out of his mind, but he believed that he had keys to paradise. And he formed a group up in the mountains that, you know, there, Alamut. And he promised his followers paradise in this earth by smoking hashish and having harems. And if they died for him as assassins, they would go to paradise. And his people trained in the martial arts. So they trained like ninja. You know the Japanese ninja who cover their face, you know, with black. So these hashashin, they train themselves, and they hide. They'll hide in your ceiling if they're supposed to assassinate you for a week. And then they fall down on top of you and poison you to death. So even the word assassin comes from hashashin. That's an Arabic word. Because hash, right, is the drugs that they smoked. So the people who are smoking this hashish, right, hashashin, So the word become assassin, and we're using it today, the assassin, the Assassin's Creed, right? That's an Arabic word. So these people were attacking the Muslim world, terrorizing the Muslims, and the Seljuks had to deal with them militarily, but Imam al-Ghazali and the Nizamiya Madrasa had to deal with their ideas, okay? So this was a main struggle that was going on there. Unfortunately, in 1092, the assassins succeeded in killing Nizam al-Mulk. And they killed a lot of the Seljuk leaders were killed by them, Abbasids. It was very difficult to really defeat them because of their abilities. It was only the Mongols. When the Mongols came, one of the good things the Mongols did was to stop the assassins. Okay, but otherwise, it was very difficult to get with them. But the death of Nizam al-Mulk had an impact on the life of Imam al-Ghazali. And the struggling going on in the courts, and even they say Imam al-Ghazali had an intellectual crisis. He had an intellectual crisis because he studied so much philosophy. He started going into terminologies and things so much that spiritually he was drained. He started to lose the spirit of Islam. You know, there's great scholars, Imam al-Razi. You know, for instance, they ask, Imam al-Razi about Qadr, about the will of Allah. This is a big topic in Islam. We have a will and Allah has a will. So where does our will meet Allah's will? Does Allah know everything you're going to do? Does he control your will? So there's a philosophical debate that goes on about that. So they went to the Imam and they said, tell us about Al-Qadr. He said, if you want to know the truth about the will of Allah, look outside at the farmers, this fallah. The farmers, they know that if they don't work and plant their crops, nothing will grow. But they do all the work and then they wait for Allah to send the rain. That's the perfect understanding of Qadr. So you don't sit around and think that Allah is going to do everything. You do all the things that you need to do, but you depend ultimately on the will of Allah. You see? These philosophical type of debates. And so Imam al-Ghazali, rahimahullah, he had a crisis. He had a personal crisis. He had studied most of the books, memorized everything. Nobody could out-debate him in any topic. You could not out-debate this man. But he started to feel a vacuum inside, right? And this is why studying too much in areas, it can actually kill your heart. Especially in areas where you start to question, why did Allah do this? Right? Because ultimately our iman, you know, is the power in back of everything that we are doing. But we use our reason in order to understand what is happening in the world. So Imam al-Ghazali had a crisis and he heard that there were people who had dedicated their life to spirituality. This is what you'd call people of tasawwuf or the Sufis at that time. And they would do what is called khalwa. They go out and they give up the world. And so he wanted to experience this. Okay, so he left his teaching post in the most prestigious institute in the Muslim world. And he went to try to find some people like this. And he ended up spending a lot of time in Jerusalem, you know, there in the masjid, in the minaret and around there, you know, spending time by himself. And while he was there, after a few years, then he realized there was still a turmoil in the Muslim world. And so he returned to his teachings. This is Imam al-Ghazali. He returned to teaching in Naysapur, and started to answer some of the questions of the people again. He was more balanced now because he had answered some of the spiritual questions that he had. And they say he ended his life reading hadith. He was actually studying hadith and teaching it at the end of his life. So he went through a lot of changes. But it is during this change when he had to answer a lot of the questions of the Muslim world. And some of these questions can't be answered alone by the text. It's something wrong with our hearts. Something was missing. And so he wrote a book called Ihya Ulum al-Din. So this is the revival of the religious sciences. So he literally looked at a way to revive the teachings of Islam and the spirit of Islam and to try to synthesize what was going on. Some people became extreme in Sufism, where they went outside of fiqh. Some people went extreme in the texts, in being textual, and they lost their spirituality. So what Imam Ghazali was doing, he was trying to harmonize the two sides, what some people would call the outward religious practices and the inward religious practices. In the time of the Prophet ﷺ, it was all the same. There was no outward Islam and inward Islam. But because of the changes that Muslims had gone through, because of the philosophies that came into the Muslim world, because of the extremes, some scholars had to balance this. He was one of the scholars, and there are others who actually took this on. And in this major work he did, Ihya Ulum al-Din, he was able to answer some of the issues, the spiritual issues, and to try to synthesize things so people become more balanced and not into extremes. And so by the end of his life, he returned to Nishapur, and he continued. He ended his life teaching, and his teachings and his influence is touching us up until today. And so this is what one of the things we need today, because we have a lot of extremes in the Muslim world. We have some groups, we even do takfir on each other. This one's not Muslim, and this one is not following my sheikh, or not following my aqidah, or not following my school of thought. So this type of synthesis is needed today. Okay? And this came about because of the coming together of the ruler and the scholar. You see? So when the two sides can come together, when that power in the Muslim world can come together, we find there can be great results. And so this is what we recognize, what had happened during the time of the Seljuks. It was like a golden age for scholarship. There were a lot of trials and tribulations that were going on, but alhamdulillah, it was a great period of time, and there's a great legacy coming out of this this golden age of Islam. So I want to open up the floor for any questions that you may have on this. Again, this is to show the cooperation between the scholars and the rulers. And it is such an important gathering or synthesis that is needed today. So the floor is open for any questions that anybody may have there. Yeah, the Muslim world is very complex. And you know, the question comes, you know, why are the Shias like coming to the aid of, you know, of the Sunnis? Why? You know, what we have to realize, and I say this because I lived in Medina for a period of time and I experienced, you know, Iranian people and all types of people. And you'll find that, you know, 90% or so of what Shiites do, I'm not talking about the extreme groups like Druze and the Ismailis and the ones, but 90% of what the mainstream Shia do is Islam. It's 90% Islam. The 10% is where some of their beliefs come in, extreme things, and they're in different groups, come in. So the fact of a group of Muslims in the Muslim world fighting against evil, wanting to be shaheed, it's not just a Shiite ideology, that's Islam. And it manifests itself through them. Because most of where they're coming from is Islam. And that's the complexity of the Muslim world. But what you have to realize when you look at the situation in Palestine and Gaza is that the tip of the spear for the Muslim world are the people of Gaza, the people of Palestine. And they are 100% Sunni, 100%. So therefore, it is a struggle that involves all elements within the Muslim world. And if you just go to ideas and start arguing about ideas, you can see differences. But if you look on the ground, people's countries are under attack, evil is there. To stand up against evil is an Islamic act. And it has nothing to do with your grouping that you're doing, it is following the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, through Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Question.
Where are the Saudi scholars and other Gulf scholars in supporting the Palestinians?
Yeah, so this is the situation now. Again, the Muslim world is very complex. I do not have the answers of what's happening in the Muslim countries. However, you can see that there's a big problem happening where the leaders generally do not represent the people. They do not represent Islam. And in some cases, some parts of the Muslim world, they are actually suppressing scholars. So scholars have been imprisoned and suppressed in different parts of the Muslim world. In these classes, we don't go into names calling this country and that person. We're dealing with issues. And so, yes, there is suppression of the scholars, and there needs to be the true coming of the real Muslim. That's why we're studying this course, to try to understand, at least for the younger generation and the new Muslims and revive Muslims, you know, so we can see where we have to go for the future. Yeah. Well, you know, again, to look at history, you know, the Muslim world is very complex. And we have to understand, you know, what has happened, especially in the past 200 years, you know, what is called the colonial period, when the Muslim countries were conquered over, you know, by European, you know, European colonialism. And you'll see that in the 20th century, the great movements that struggled against colonialism were generally led by scholars. Abdul Qadir of Algeria, Imam Shamil of Chechnya, Muhammad Ahmed of the Sudan. And, you know, you will see great scholars, you know, in Libya, all over. You'll see the scholars taking Umar Mukhtar, right, Sheikh Umar Mukhtar. He's a great scholar of Libya. He led, you know, the revolutionaries, you know, against the Italians. So you will see the scholars who are directly involved, okay? And that's up until recent struggles that have gone on in different parts, you know, of the Muslim world. You'll see the scholars, you know, involved. But our problem is now we are broken into so many small pieces because of colonialism and then our own tribalism and nationalism. That in terms of a movement, like you have Seljuk's movement, to have a movement that actually represents will take some time. So scholars are struggling, scholars are dying, scholars are involved, you know, and rulers of different types are there. And the more we come back to the Book of Allah and the Sunnah, inshallah, is the closer we'll get, you know, to our answer, but it will take some time. Any other questions online?
Yes. Assalamu alaikum. The fact that the Turks, Mongols, and nearby Arabs retained their cultural practices after their conversion to Islam, is it an indication that culture can be complementary to Islam?
Yes. The question is the fact that the Turks and many people retained their culture after Islam, you know, does it show that culture can be part of Islam? Yes. Islam does not come to take you away from your culture. So whatever your culture is, because culture, we're talking about your customs and your behaviors and your language and your food, and you know that is developed over centuries. If you live in a mountain in Afghanistan, your culture is not going to be the same as somebody who lives on a seashore in Malaysia. Because in Malaysia is a nice, you know, 30 degree temperature all year round, mangoes coming down, and you know, people smile and they're easygoing. You know, in the mountain of Afghanistan is rough all the time. People are rougher in how they deal. So there's going to be a culture that's developed. So what Islam actually does, you know, is it purifies the culture. You know, so what Islam actually does is it's like a filter. So you have a glass. So you have two glasses. One has got milk. Another one's got orange juice. And then you put a filter on your cup. So you pour the milk into the cup. And the filter, which is your Islam, it takes away all the impurities that were in the milk. But what you finally have in that cup is milk. It doesn't turn into lemonade. It's milk. The same way with the orange juice that you just squeezed. And you pour it into the cup with the filter, which is Islam. The filter takes away all the impurities of the orange, but the juice is still orange. So therefore, you will find halal food with pepper, halal food, you know, with all types of things. It's halal. So that's the culture. So your culture can be part of Islam. And for the most part, what I've found in Muslim countries is the majority of the practice of the people from Muslim countries, you know, is Islamic, especially in their lifestyle, in their families, and their food, especially those who are not in cities, those who are in countrysides. Because the countryside, the country people tend to maintain the culture more. So a lot of the ways. However, there are some bad ways from before Islam that people carried into Islam. Some of them, you know, have remained up until today. And Islam has to purify that. You know, like for instance, you know, when I went to Turkey and visited there, they always have this blue eye. So if you go to a Turkish house or a restaurant, you'll see this blue eye covered with, it's turquoise covered with dark blue. It's this eye. And it's something to do with Tengri, right? It's their previous religion. Okay, and they believe in the power of this amulet that it protects you from evil. And that stayed with them. When they were practicing Islam, you don't see it that much. When they start to get into superstition, you'll start to see this thing coming up. But now, alhamdulillah, they're actually taking away a lot of these eyes now. People are realizing this is a bad, this is our, you know, pre-Islamic ignorance to believe in the amulet and not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, so culture is culture, and Islam filters out the bad part of the culture. Any other questions anybody has? Floor is open.
Just a reminder, the book that Nizam al-Mulk wrote about efficient government bureaucracy, what was that called again?
Nizam al-Mulk's book that he wrote is called Siyasat Nama. Siyasat Nama. So judging by the title, it's probably in Persian. Because siyasa does come from Arabic. Siyasa means politics. But Nama, that's Persian. So it was probably a Persian book. It may be translated into English, though. So Siyasat Nama by Nizam al-Mulk. This is his work on governance. Al-Marwardi. Al-Marwardi is a Arabic-speaking famous writer. He wrote a book about Siyasat al-Shar'iyya, about Siyasa, politics, and Islam, Al-Marwardi. You know, he wrote a book about Islamic politics. So there are a few writers who have actually, you know, done this, but this was Nizam al-Mulk.
When we look at like government politics, and then we look at where the scholar comes in to kind of influence, because like there's so many different parts that the government plays in creating a city, right? Like for example, even the examples that you gave, it's not only about like fit rulings or dealing with the people; it's also sometimes like structural, right? So like. Whenever the scholar would come in and influence things, what, like, almost like departments or like sections, where did they have the most control or say over? Because, you know, there's things like, for example, like sewage, storm, drainage, those kind of systems.
Yeah.
Even like, but things like urban planning, like the street networks, the placement of, major places that people gather, whether it's like markets or the masjid and that sort of thing. What place would the scholars have influence over those?
Well, you know, the scholars, of course, when we talk about scholars in the original Islamic way, a scholar is not just somebody who only studies Hadith and Quran. The scholar could actually be an engineer, too. The scholar could be a doctor. The scholar could be an architect. So that they combine, you know, different things. And so really, you know, science is science. If you got to build a dam, you got to build a dam. But the thing is, though, is that where the scholarship comes in, is that there may be an issue concerning a graveyard. So is it permissible to build a highway through that graveyard? Or how do you deal with the graveyard? That's where you got to get a scholar. Now, if the architects or the engineers have scholarship, they can solve it. But if they don't, then they'll have to go to somebody who has scholarship. He analyzes this, and he may tell them, no, you got to go around. That's the fatwa. So that's where fatwa is needed. But, you know, when we look at scholarship in general, it does include sciences and, you know, other things as well, you know, within the area of scholarship. Today, a lot of things have been, it's the secular way of doing things from the colonial period. Religion and secular, you know, it's church and state. That's a secular way. We didn't separate church from state. It was the same. It's all part of the same. That's right. So the secularism comes in, you know, for worldly, you know, issues as opposed to submission to Allah Subhanahu wa Taala. Okay. So. No problem. Okay, so we're going to end the class now, and inshallah, we'll go on to another interesting relationship with scholars and, you know, leaders, to try to get some answers to our problems today. So I leave you with these thoughts. Wa akhira da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.